Vices Radio Network.
If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at his website, fortitudetraining.net. Those who purchase Scott's book or any of his coaching products receive a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. So check out fortitudetraining.net. Muscle Minds is made possible in part by Jordan Peters. If you've enjoyed listening to Jordan today, check out his website, trainedbyjp.com. The site offers over 50 hours of video content covering everything from the most basic approach to training and nutrition for beginners, all the way through advanced anabolic and insulin strategies for seasoned competitors. You can follow Jordan and Corin's blog as they prep for their next shows and have questions answered daily on their forum section. So check out trainedbyjp.com. The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting, presented by Nance Gear.
Welcome to Muscle Minds, Episode 2. With me, as always, is Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson. This is our first episode of the year. Guys, we're back. Jordan, how you doing today, man?
I'm very well, thank you.
Awesome. Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you too, brother.
Thank you very much.
Scott, how's your day going, man?
Life is beautiful. I should probably be feeling guilty because it's just another gorgeous day in Florida. There's like maybe some cloudiness out there, but it's a nice breeze, the sunshine. I woke up and went out and sat, out in my yard to start the day, to answer emails, et cetera. So it's just grand, man. No complaints.
Man, that sounds awesome. So Jordan, did you guys do anything fun for New Year's, or were you like me? Did you go to bed at 11 o'clock?
Yeah, I was in bed fairly early, and I managed to stay awake until midnight, and then I fell asleep just after.
I went to sleep at 11:15. I woke up at 12:30 because I was hungry, and I ate some more food, and then I went back to bed, and that was it. How about you, Scott? What did you do?
I think I actually was in bed at 9:30. To be honest.
No kidding.
I had an intensive cruise this week, so I was taking time away from the gym.
Okay.
And I cleaned the house. I mean, gosh, I had talked before about working on my Jeep in the past, and I don't have a garage. So my basic living room, which is sort of a section off area of the house, was my construction zone. there was tools everywhere, and still, I've been cutting boards, so there's sawdust on the floor. And so I cleaned that out, and I put a new battery in my Harley, and so I got to make sure she was running good and
nice.
Just doing all sorts of I'm riding around on New Year's Day, on my Harley with just shirt on.
Man.
So actually, I did have a leather jacket on for those who are concerned about safety, but but it was warm, and. Yeah, so I was doing all that, and I just I'm going to eat and just go to bed. There's no one, no party. I asked a couple people, but there weren't anything going on that really seemed inviting, so just rested.
Nice. It sounds like a pretty decent day to me. I'd take that, and I'd take the nice weather too. You've shown me some pictures. You're eating lunch on a dock, and you're driving around with the top down on your Jeep, and I'm getting ready to shovel snow over here.
I know. I mean, I've been there. I've done that, you know, growing up, the whole snow thing. But, yeah, I take this. See, the thing, I think some people don't like the heat. I mean, people complain about the heat and or the humidity.
Yeah.
And that's not an issue at all for me. Like, this is just my temperament matches hot environments really, really well. So it's beautiful now. And when I'm a sweater. I'll be sweating all the time, especially if, you know, I'm heavier.
Yeah.
I just don't care. It just doesn't bother me. So there are no negatives in terms of a hotter kind of tropic. And it is really kind of tropical around here.
Okay.
Environment. So yeah, so I'm good with it, man.
I know the feeling, man. I sweat constantly. The more weight I put on, the more I sweat. Jordan, mm-hmm. I imagine, man, when you're hitting like 275, are you sweating through all your clothes over there?
I'm really hot all the time. I'm literally like a furnace.
I bet.
It's the thermic effect of Jordan, essentially.
So it's like 2 degrees today and I still had flip flops on because I just radiate heat constantly.
Nice.
It's a blessing in some aspects. You never feel cold.
Right.
I can't remember the last time I was cold. It's frustrating because I can't bear to be in hot rooms.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to die.
What about training, man? Some of the gyms out here, we don't have any air conditioning, and in the summer, it's brutal. How do you do on, say, like a heavy set of squats in a room that's just like boiling?
I'm fine. I love to sweat when I train.
Okay.
I really love it in the summer here when it's hot, and you sweat when you train. I normally take a couple changes of t-shirt, and I have to change usually once, sometimes twice.
Man.
It's a lot of fun. But I love that feeling of just being fucking drenched in sweat. Sessions. That's when you know you're fucking.
Nice. Well, listen, so guys, this past week, I don't know if your ears have been buzzing at all, Scott. There's been a lot of talk on the Advices Radio Network about training methods. And your name has come up a couple times, actually. You know, Skip and I and S2H were talking about training, and that segued into VJ and I talking about training on Bodybuilding Nerds. Here's the kind of the question, and I wanted to see what your thoughts were. So somebody had asked a question, and it was something along the lines of, you know, when I started training as a kid, I just got in the gym, I lifted heavy weights, I got out and I ate and I grew. Somewhere along the lines, training systems have gotten to be a lot more complex. Do we really need to take things to that level of complexity? So, of course, from there, names like Mountain Dog, names like Fortitude came up. And I wanted to get you guys to weigh in on this and see what you think. And I know there's a lot of different variables. I know that it's going to be different for everybody. Some people are going to be relatively newbies to the gym, and their situation is going to be, say, a lot different than, let's say, Jordan's situation. What do you think about this, Scott?
Well, the thing is, if you find an effective training strategy, what many people don't do is ride that out as long as they possibly can. And that literally can be for someone who is kind of a grinder by personality and is eating appropriately to support seeing gains where they don't get discouraged and want to program hop, which is really kind of the issue a lot of people have. Although bodybuilders like delayed gratification to a certain degree, we can also be impatient and we don't see what's going on.
Yeah.
So pick a strategy that works and ride that out. I mean, I did essentially dog crap training kind of per what you see online, the kind of the standard, the 3-day, or the 2-way split and the 3-way split.
Yeah.
For 7 or 8 years, I did DC training for kind of close to a decade. Of course, I was the Dante's official trainer, so I was, you know, mixing things up and developing things, and some of that eventually led to Fortitude training. But that was just go in the gym and progress as much as you can and just keep doing that. Watch your weight progress, watch your your training progress. And it was, that's a pretty simple program. You know, it's just basics. So ride that out, and without a doubt, like you can. And the other thing I think that goes into people's perceptions of who have that opinion, which is a valid one, I think, that, you know, keep it simple, keep it basic, is that most of your gains happen initially when you start training, regardless almost of whatever your approach is. Assume your average person, you know, there's a law of diminishing returns here. So let's say, you know, you start off and you've trained for 10 years. You might make, oh gosh, 3/4 of those gains, just hypothetically speaking, in the first 5 years.
Okay.
Or maybe even the first 3 to 5 years. And then you have to fight tooth and nail thereafter. But that leaves an impression on you. And the impression is, this is the dance that brung me. This was basic, simple training. And it got me there. So I know that's effective. Yeah. And that fits. That in and of itself does not mean that there aren't other strategies you can employ to make more gains, and that you might need to make more gains eventually, especially in the case of lagging body parts. There's an arsenal of other ways in which you can approach training, different than, you know, your standard kind of bro split with high volume, which never really didn't work all that well for me, to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
Because I tend to train too hard, and I would do too much, and probably was under eating too. I mean, I did that for a decade, 20 sets of 20 on squats, just because more was better. I mean, I would just like literally brutal 20 Widowmaker style sets.
My God.
Yeah. I've done that before. I'm like, I don't give a crap. I'm going to just go until my body has no choice in the matter, so to speak. But obviously it did. And the choice was to defend survival over putting on muscle mass. So yeah, I think there's validity to that, but there's also the standard training principle of variety as well.
Yeah.
And you can see this simply in changing exercises. So you've been doing deadlifts from the floor for the longest time, and you start to plateau, and so you're training hard. There's nothing lacking in your effort. And then you simply move to a rack dead or a banded dead or use chains or what have you. And things are changed ever so slightly. The first time you do that, assuming your effort and your training volume is the same, you get sore as crap.
Yeah.
Many people, at least those who get sore. So there's some novelty there. And the muscle soreness in that case would be an indicator that you provided a new stress, which is what you want in order to propel your gains. And then there's simple things like periodization, you know, and frequency of training, which can be varied. And there's also, you can periodize your training volume too. And when you then take all those bits and pieces and combine them to sort of optimize a program and look at something like that for the first time, which, you know, people might see when they look at fortitude training, it's like, oh my God, the guy's got like these two different versions, and there's 3 different volume tiers and all these different set types. It's cold. Gee, but Etley, man, this is way overthinking.
Yeah.
Just get in there and just friggin' go for it. It's like, well, if you dissect each of those pieces of my system, for instance, which I can talk about, people, I doubt many of the people who might have that first impression looking at something like fortitude training for the very first time would have an argument, would reject or have an objection to each of those pieces, because they're each supported either by my experience and or by the research. So it's like, you know, you add, I don't know, if you think about a car, obviously I don't know much about automobiles, but, you know, if you add a, you know, turbo to your vehicle, and then you add, like, you know, like a chip that helps with your efficiency, and then, you know, you change, you know, your gear ratios, so you know, and then maybe you come up with some other tricks. You do 5 or 6 things like that. Each of those adds to the performance of your vehicle.
Yeah.
But if you compare like your standard, you know, base model with the totally tricked out model, that tricked out model just looks like, wow, that's way too much. What are you thinking? And you ask that person, well, you know, does turbo make a car faster? Yes. Okay, I'm not going to argue that. Does this chip improve economy? Yes, it does. And you ask about each of those pieces, they're not going to argue with them. So why would all of them together not at least have an additive, if not a synergistic effect?
Sure.
So that's kind of my long-winded perspective on making things too complex. But still, back to where I started, I think you need to take a program that works and use it as much as you possibly can. Squeeze it, manipulate it, make it work for you as much as you can, but don't program hop, because that mindset, from what I've seen, you know, for years and years now, isn't one that gets people to where they at least think they want to go, because that's skirting the fact that you just have to work hard and be consistent if you want to make continuous gains.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was looking for. I knew that if we came to you, Scott, you would have, this is something you've probably already thought a lot about.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, when I put together Fortitude Training, I'm like, okay, what are the pieces that I've picked up on? What are the things that I've kind of known? I said, well, some people can recover better than other people. You can't just give them a standard program.
Yeah.
With a given amount of volume and assume it to match everybody. So different volume tiers. High frequency seems to work, but I came up with two different versions. I didn't want to go with like three or four. That would have just blown people away. So you always have to kind of work within the confines of you know, what people are going to be able to accept in terms of complexity. And the different set types. Okay, we know, you know, that we know from what one end of the spectrum, occlusion training or blood flow restriction training is helpful for muscle growth. So metabolic stress works. We know that loading works. So we can come up with sets that do those, and the cluster sets, which is what a rest pause set is in DC training, or the muscle rounds that I have in Fortitude Training, where I've kind of formalized how to do those, also is important. And then I could go on and on, things like avoiding too much central nervous system taxation, which, you know, relative to what the muscle can adapt to. So I just put all those pieces together. And when you put them together, it can look like, you know, Frankenstein, you know, because it's like, oh, it's way too much. But each of those in and of themselves, I think, are good pieces. So, yeah, I spent like 2 years writing that book. So I spent some time thinking about it.
I bet. So, Jordan, before you had done Fortitude Training and before you started working with Scott, what style of training did you find worked for you in the past? Just out of curiosity.
It's always been a DC-esque style approach.
Okay. So this is like a natural evolution then.
Oh, completely. I started reading on intense muscle when I was 18. So, and when I very first started training, when I was taught to train, the coaches that I had then were more Olympic lifting coaches. So their focus was more on, they were full body sessions.
Yeah.
So you came in and all you really did was squatted, benched, overhead pressed, and then did clean and press or snatch. And then that was all we did for the sessions.
Wow.
The next session we then may do pretty much the same, but with like a barbell row or a dip in place. So training like that is all I ever knew.
Hmm.
So it was really easy for me to kind of refine the DC style approach. And then even now, the stuff that I enjoy and I seem to be getting good progress from it's still similar to that of DC, but it's more a moderate volume as opposed to the ultra low volume.
Gotcha.
I have responded better now to just doing a little bit more work.
Hmm.
And it's still certainly not high volume. I'll never be a high volume trainer. But just it's just a bit more than what DC style is.
You know, since I started following some of your ideas, Jordan, my volume, I found, has been going down. I used to go in the gym even for something like arms, and I would, you know, I'd have an arm day, and I would do, you know, four exercises per muscle group, per bi and per tri, and, you know, 12 to 16 reps for triceps, and maybe, you know, 10 to 12 for biceps. And of course, there was some variation in there every week. But now I find, man, I get through a couple exercises and I'm like, man, I'm done. That's it. I'm done.
Yeah, sure. Like things like arms. Something where I've never increased the volume on. That for me, I think, is always going to bring about diminishing returns. Simply because of the rate at which you're utilizing your arms across the week.
Yeah.
So for me, I only ever do two exercises, and normally for like two sets each.
Wow.
And that will be it for my arms. Because I'm getting everything I need for my heavy pressing, really.
And people need to see, though, when you say two sets, I feel like people really need to see your videos to know what you're talking about, because I think for anybody who's coming from like a high volume approach, they think two sets, and they think two sets of what they're normally used to doing. And I have a feeling it's very different.
Well, I mean, the goal is obviously to progress your logbook. So in that, obviously your strength on a whole from year to year should be increasing, but it's quite hard in every single run to be at an all-time strongest on every single exercise. It's not realistic. You're going to have phases of injury and phases of diet that will just see your strength dip somewhat.
Yeah. But
in each run that you're doing, the goal is to be beating the previous time you did this lift. So the intensity in that moment is a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
And there's no doubts about it. Because if you're beating a number that you did and that beat the time before that, and that beat the time before that, let's say you're into like a fifth crack at progressing this lift, that's going to be a hard set. And there's just no comparison to an 8 to 10 rep feeder set where someone will do four sets and then eventually come to failure through just that fatigue that's occurred.
Yeah.
I hate that way of training. Like, absolutely no disrespect to William Bonnack at all, because it just sounds ludicrous, me insulting an Olympian, because he was brilliant.
Yeah.
I hated that session, because it's just, I know that would be impossible for me to make progress training that. I would regress so fast. Like, it's taken me a long time to get my back to the density it's at, and it would just wither away within months if I started training like that.
Yeah.
Because at that kind of volume, it's impossible to get stronger. It really is. And you need to find a volume that allows you to get stronger. And certainly less is more in this way.
Interesting. Yeah, I just, you know, like I said, this topic had just come up a few times, and I know that everybody listening to the show has heard the other guys talk about this stuff. So I thought it would be I just wanted to take a minute to kind of touch base here on that with you guys. But we've got a lot of really good questions. And to start out, Scott, you had one that you had gotten through your board at Fortitude Training, right?
Yeah, I get lots of good questions. I think we could probably interject those here now and again.
I thought my thought was too, and we discussed this before the show, I think that the the Advices Radio, the forums page that we have set up, it's a great place for us to get and gather information, but we might not always use all of it. We've kind of touched on that before, but I just feel like, you know, Jordan, you're talking to somebody when you're a client, or you're having a conversation with a colleague, or Scott, you get asked this cool question, and these are things that stand out to you, and there are things that you're already thinking about and you're feeling passionate about. That's the stuff I want to hear about from you guys, you know, because that's kind of like where your heart is right now. So I thought this
we should disseminate the pearls of wisdom that we come across, you know?
Yeah. So, I thought this was a great place to start. I'm going to start with your question here, Scott. And it starts out with him talking about a thread that you guys had previously had open. So, but don't worry, everybody, you'll catch up here really quick. He says, "Sorry to revive an old thread here, Scott, but was just reading through and am curious. You mentioned above the altering days of focusing carbohydrate intake around the workout perimeter and off days being in a calorie deficit. This is exactly what I am attempting now, alternating between training days being high carbohydrate and trace fats, then the rest of the days being high fat with trace carbs. My goal is muscle gain. He'd like to gain 1 to 2 pounds of weight per what's a fortnight? I don't even know what that is.
2 weeks.
Oh, per 2 weeks. I didn't even know that. Okay. My question is, I am tracking my weight increasing. How do I ensure that I am in a calorie deficit on those rest days? My calories are certainly lower on those days than on my training days. Right now, by 400 calories. What did you tell him on this one, Scott?
Well, it's a good thing he didn't start talking about how many stone he wants to gain in a fortnight and how many kilojoules his caloric excess or deficiency should be.
I would have gotten real confused.
Like, what in the world? What does stones have to do with any of this? This isn't about your testicles. What's going on? this is basically, he's asking about the general approach to diet, which is a nutrient timing approach that I put forth in the Fortitude Training book, where you take advantage of a post-workout, quote-unquote, anabolic window or a post-workout period when you've got the greatest increases in protein turnover.
Hashtag Slindo.
That's your Slindo, baby. Yeah. The Slindo might be shorter than the post-workout period.
Oh, okay.
But I guess it depends on the person. Yeah. We'll have to, maybe that'll be a future topic we can dig into. But so the idea you take in, and this is pretty much what Jordan has talked about doing and what I typically do with most people, is you want to enhance your recovery as much as you possibly can during that period. So that's when you load in your food, particularly carbohydrate, and you're matching your activity level on a particular day as well, such as your training days include more food and your non-training days include less food. And the main macronutrient that you're varying there is carbohydrate and as well as fat. So during a high carb period, you're going to take in less fat because of the potential slowing of digestion. You're really, if you're someone, especially Jordan size, or you're just pushing your whatever your own gastrointestinal limits are, you want that food to get in and out as soon as you can so that you can get in those calories. And I've had some clients who, you know, pack down, you know, pretty tremendous amounts of calories in their post-workout meals. So that's kind of the basic idea. And so what he was asking about is he wanted to, in particular, specifically know that he's in a caloric deficit on non-training days and he's in caloric excess on training days. Well, the deficit or the excess on training days is, you know, pretty obvious one to do. If you weigh, you know, 200 pounds and you're taking in 5,000 calories on those days and, it's, you know, you're probably in an excess, especially if it's 6,000 calories, you most certainly are. And the deficit is maybe a bit different. And as far as specifically measuring that thing, those deficits or excesses relative to your caloric expenditure, you're not going to be able to know that unless you have access to a bomb calorimeter where you measure heat an individual puts off, you know, and you could also quantify whatever work they're maybe doing. Maybe you have to have actually a gym that would be a bomb calorimeter, to be honest, and you have to quantify the external work that they're doing. Be a highly, highly complex experiment that's never been done, to my knowledge. Or so, you'd have to have...
What you're saying is it can't happen.
Yeah, I mean, you can use indirect calorimetry where you're measuring oxygen consumption, and that is indirect calorimetry, so an indirect measure of caloric expenditure, calories burned. And so then you'd have to also know on the other side of the coin, you know, you can get into all the minute details here. You know, are the Atwater's values for calories per gram and for carbs and protein, at least usable energy, and 9 for fat, are those accurate? And are your labels accurate on your foods that you're eating? I mean, sometimes those labels don't even make mathematical sense when you add things up. So all of those things would have to go into this if you really wanted to know. But the main thing is just to take it, don't overthink this, and just take the global strategy that you're gonna take in an excess, or you're gonna take in a majority or larger amount of your calories on training days in comparison to non-training days. And that's just a nutrient timing approach. So I thought that was a decent question, because people will go back and they will do things like, I'm going to use the Harris-Benedict equation. You can find sites where you plug in your weight,
yeah, yeah,
and then you put in, like, you know, what's your general activity level, light, moderate, heavy, and then it'll give you an estimate of what your caloric expenditure is on a per day basis. And roughly, for someone with kind of average activity level, you know, they're not working construction, but they're, you know, they also don't, you know, they're not sitting in front of a desk all day long, it's going to be about 15 calories per pound, something like that. But all these things change as you change your caloric intake and expenditure. So you've got some changes in metabolism, and there'll also be some changes in your non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So for instance, if someone's dieting down, one of the things we've talked about here, I think, before is, you know, you get tired, you get sluggish when you're dieting, and that spontaneous activity that you might normally have doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So your caloric expenditure goes away. Hmm. So really, you know, all these things are going to be all over the place, and the extent to which, you know, any particular caloric excess that you take in is actually going to produce an increase in size or just a change in body weight, as well as the relative percent that happens with body fat, is going to be a function of your genetics, as well as what happens to your NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and your metabolism. And there's possibly even some minor interaction with thermic effect of feeding, that kind of thing, but that would be very, very, very minimal. And I think I might as well just bring it up. I didn't answer this. I didn't put this in my answer on the board, but I think I've talked about it before here. I know I have on several podcasts. There's a really cool set of twin studies that a guy named Claude Bouchard did up in Canada. He's a geneticist, and he's been at it for a long time, trying to figure out the genetics of body weight regulation. And in these studies, they took fraternal and identical twins, and they found a baseline that kept their body weight stable, and they measured their caloric expenditure during exercise and throughout the course of a day. So they did pretty much a complete metabolic profile to figure out what a baseline diet is that was caloric balance for these individuals. So they've got some fraternal twins, which are genetically very similar, like brother and sister.
Yeah.
And they had identical twins, so same genes. Minor differences in how they might respond according to their epigenetics, but, you know, genetically identical, except for whatever mutations might happen. So in one study, they had them eat 1,000 calories a day above this baseline caloric intake, 6 out of 7 days a week for like about 3 months.
Hmm.
And the other study, they reduced their caloric intake and had them do 500 calories worth of exercise on a cyclergometer each day, 6 out of 7 days per week for about 3 months. And if there were no differences whatsoever in the expenditure side of the coin amongst all these individuals, then, you know, your standard, like, you know, 3,500 calories per pound of fat would have added up. You could add that up and everyone would have gained the same amount of body fat. You also would have seen, if all humans were identical, you would have seen the same increase in fat-free mass,
yeah,
amongst everyone, all over the place. Threefold range in the changes in body weight, and roughly a threefold range in the changes in fat-free mass and in body fat. So it was all over the place. What they found, interestingly enough, is if you compare the fraternal twins, very, very close. So let's say one set of fraternal twins, twin A might have gained like 3 pounds in the overfeeding study, and the other twin gained like 5 pounds. Then if you looked at another set of twins, this time identical, that set of twins might have gained like 9.6 and 9.9 pounds.
Hmm.
So twice as much, or more than twice as much on average in terms of weight gain, even though they all were given the same caloric excess based on this baseline. So the adaptation, the adaptive thermogenesis that occurred and whatever happened with their energy expenditure throughout the rest of the day was highly genetically determined, such that the identical twins, you know, experienced essentially the same change in body composition twin by twin. But when you looked across twin pairs, all over the place. So you try to then take it back to this question of this person like trying to make sure they're in a caloric deficit on their non-training days. Well, that being a tip in what is technically a caloric deficit, if they can even measure that, might mean they never make any gains. Like that would be, you don't want that because their body has such a strong set point or settling point in terms of maintaining body fat and body weight and maybe even muscle mass too, that's just not going to happen for them. They have to have an extreme excess on training days, and they have to have somewhat of an excess on non-training days. So looking at it in terms of excess and deficiency is probably not the best way. What you need to do is be more of an artiste, so to speak, and adjust the diet in ways that match you. So on a training day, you know, eat maybe as much as you can. And then once you've maxed that out, you would add calories on a non-training day when you still have the ability to eat a little more food. And both of those days could be caloric excesses.
Okay.
For a given person. So there's another short answer for you.
Nice. Yeah. We had a bunch of stuff we mentioned last week from White Ox over at the thread at the Advices Radio Forum. We could just knock through some of these real quick. I wanted to turn to Jordan because I felt like this is a question where I've heard Jordan talk about this topic a lot. And this is central nervous system recovery. He just simply asks, what are some strategies, he says, or supplements for recovering the central nervous system when pushing either intensity or volume to its limits?
You'll reach a point at which you then actually just have to deload. It just depends how long you can stick in that kind of phase of walking the line between just about recovering and then being kind of fucked up for a bit post session or maybe the next day and being able to recover again in time. This was one of the problems that I was having in the summer here. And I spoke to Scott a few times about it because I was absolutely destroying myself. And I, for the first time in a while, I just could not recover.
I remember.
And like I said, it was just akin to being tranquilized. I was just walking around in a daze.
Remember the picture you guys sent me? That you and Corn sent?
Bent over on the chair. Yeah.
He basically ran. I gotta interject here. He basically was, I've been there before too. He's so whacked out and tired. He was like, I think you're getting up off the floor and he just sort of like made it halfway up and you're like, oh, this feels good. I'm not moving. He's just like, it's like lying on this footstool. It's hilarious.
It's like, I'm stuck here. Every part of my body was totally fucked. But what kept happening was I then would just about be able to recover by the next session and then I'd go again. I don't think that's a great place to be when you're that messed up. I didn't make progress through that phase of the summer. I didn't, and I couldn't gain any weight, and it was only then when I introduced insulin that I was actually able to start properly utilizing carbohydrates, it seemed, because my body was just so smashed to bits that I wasn't filling out after training, and it was just a bit of a mess, really. So if you are in that place, you're overdoing it for sure. So remember always to be mindful of it's not what you can do in a session, it's most certainly what you can recover from. So it's good that this person has highlighted recovery strategies. I have always been very aware of my stress levels, how much sleep I get, how much my workload will take away from what I'm trying to achieve. And I try to avoid things that will impair that. I'm good at relaxing. And that's really important if you want to get big, because you have to just let your body shut off and grow. So those are really, really important things. Like if you're someone that's training really, really hard and then you're working night shifts and you're on your feet a lot, your sleep is impaired, that makes it hard to grow. Now, obviously, if that's the individual situation and it's unavoidable, so be it. But the aspects that you can control, then try to control them. From a kind of a supplementation perspective, I've implemented some things, but this was under Scott's direction as well. We used a licorice tincture, I believe. And we used, Scott, what else did we use?
I think it was that tincture you got on, may have gotten on Amazon, a stress relief tincture, and it,
yeah.
I don't remember what was in there. It had licorice root, it may have had ginseng,
ashwagandha,
yeah. Rhodiola rosea is a good one.
Yeah, I had that in as well, yeah. That I thought was brilliant, actually. That certainly picked me back up and got me going again. But then those sort of things are short-lived if you're still then not adjusting your volume, your frequency, and your intensity, because that's essentially going to be the underlying issue. It's the aspects that you can control constantly.
Yeah.
And then I like to drag blasts out on training by then just taking extra rest days. And I'll have a phase where I'll just train day on, day off for a while. Just to try to eke out a little bit more, because I just hate taking a week off. And then even when I do, I only last 5 days. like I said, if you can just control as much as you can, and just be, because this is a thing, like, and I say this to Corin a lot. I say, like, when we get home from training, all I am thinking about is trying to rest and recover.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware of that in my mind. And I'll think to myself, I'm going to sit here and I'm not going to fucking move all evening. Whereas, like, Dr. Scott will know what Corinne's like. And trying to get her to sit down is a tar.
Yeah.
This is what I have to try to say to her. I'm like, be mindful of this. Actually, actively rest and say to yourself, I'm going to just chill for the evening and just sit and do whatever work you've got to do and just relax and then just shut down movement. And you're just going to preserve some calories and just allow your body to recover a lot better. But you've got to be mindful of this. It's got to be something you actively do, I think.
I like that. Yeah, I've always heard, like, you know, I used to work a very physical job, and people always would say stuff like, oh, yeah, that job's great for you because you get to work out all day. And they don't understand.
Right.
If I had a physical job, it would just be impossible for me to put on weight.
Yeah.
I believe that. Like, because, man, in my off season where I've grown the most, I swear I would nap for, like, half the day. And then obviously, like, properly sleep for half the day. And then between that, I would just be waking up and eating. I promise you, I had off seasons where that's all I did was sleep, eat, and train. And then obviously answer emails as well. And it's crazy how much that works when you really let your body recover.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why I hate traveling. If I have to do things where I have to travel, like I was meant to go to India today, I think I was meant to go, with Body Power to do some seminar stuff out there. And it got to the point where last week where it was stressing me out so much with all the work that I have to do for school at the moment and just so busy with the online work and then really wanting to nail my own training that I was just like, I just can't go. Because mentally it's just going to just destroy me. I hate not being able to rest and recover.
I think that's a great answer. Scott, I wanted to ask you this next one because I feel like you've already given us a lot of really great and fun tips. You've gotten everybody super excited about different food ideas. And he asks, ideas for easy, digestible foods when you're consuming over 6,000 calories, and possible strategies that you can implement to keep hunger and digestion going.
Well, there's so many little things. Some people doing just a little bit of cardio. This is something that Dante used to always talk about with DC training. And something that he found too, and I found too, is people would say, you know, DC training is not, you know, it's definitely not a high volume training system. You know, if you warm up and do a somewhat extensive warm up, the volume isn't as low as people think it is. But he always was big on people doing their morning fasted cardio and how the effect that would have on their hunger.
Yeah.
And so many people saw that to be the case. So. That just makes sense. If you do too much cardio, it can actually impair your appetite. Some of the there's the research on that looked into a long time ago, but just empirically speaking, a little bit of cardio can be very helpful. Another one that Dante, that people would criticize, is the idea that he had of alternating carbohydrate and non-carbohydrate meals. Doing that, and I did that for years, does seem to help you get in more calories. And it's sort of on a meal-to-meal basis. You have a higher carb meal, and then the next meal you would make higher in fat, and it seems easier to get that one in. And then by that time, you haven't had any carbs for maybe 5-6 hours, and that next high carb meal goes down more easily in a back-and-forth fashion. If you are eating low carbs on a non-training day, or even just a no carb or a low carb meal before you work out and then put in an intra workout, all of those strategies seem to allow you to pack in more food, intra workout and post workout. Jordan does this, you know, if you really, want to pack in a lot of food and after your workout, then, you know, have fewer carbs the day before and your appetite will be pretty tuned up.
Interesting.
Yeah. Spices can help a lot. Ginger helps with digestion. Fennel helps with digestion. There's a whole bunch of Indian spices. Triphala is one that seems to help a lot of people. I think it's three spices mixed together. Watch out. Triphala has some drug interactions.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a funny story. After we're done with this question, I'll tell you a funny story about triphala, what it did to me once. Garam marsala is a blend of spices that works really well for that. Cardamom's another one. There's tons of that's one of the reasons why. I mean, spices have phenomenal health benefits as well in helping with inflammation and improving our free radical status or antioxidant status. But they also help with digestion. So you can imagine, you know, in times of old, when the wealthy have access to spices from far and wide, and they're feasting on large amounts of food, they're going to, whether they're knowing this is happening or not, spices, one, they make the food taste better. So you eat more of that. And that's one of my other big tips, is eat tasty food and vary your food. You know, don't get hooked into just eating, you know, just chicken breast and rice or what have you, that sort of age-old, quote-unquote, mistake that people make. But the digestive properties of spices can help as well. So you get flavor, which is good, which makes it easier to put down food because it's new and different, and you get a digestive effect. So condiments and spices can be really, really helpful. Benefiber, people like to use psyllium husk sometimes. That can sort of seems like it slows digestion. Benefiber is it's kind of a man-made fiber. It's a soluble fiber that you can get Walgreens and get on Amazon.com. It's pretty much everywhere. And it seems to have a really nice regulatory effect on keeping your bowels healthy, in that if you're someone who tends, especially if you're eating a lot of food, to have diarrhea, the benefiber will help things stick together better, so you have formed bowel movements. And if you tend to be constipated, the benefiber tends to improve your bowel movements. So, you know, there's your enteric nervous system is pretty complex. There's lots of neurons there. So if you've got your pipes are stuffed up at one end, you know, it's not really just a mechanical system, but it's got a sensory system whereby if you're constipated or your large intestine, your colon is full, this is going to have an impact on movement all the way through your gastrointestinal tract.
Yeah.
And it's going to mean that your stomach's going to be fuller. And that in of itself is going to impair your hunger. And simply, you know, take the old dietary trick when you're dieting down. It's just like you're really hungry, you know what to do. Just slam a liter of water, and that'll put off your hunger for quite a while.
Yeah.
So if your bowels aren't moving and your stomach is fuller, that's not a good thing for getting in more food. And the other trick, I got this from Trevor, what's his name, from Nuclear Nutrition, who died. He was 400 pounds, monster. Trevor, blanking on his last name, gigantic guy. He was in favor of super high cycles, short-lived cycles. There are a million people out there saying, Scott, it's Trevor, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I don't know who it is offhand.
Yeah, I can't think of it. The name will hit me like later in the podcast. So I'll just blurt it out. Trevor Smith.
Ah.
Got it. Trevor, one of his little tricks that I've used before is if you've got a lot of protein shakes, you're gonna mix up or just have one in the morning or what have you, and it tends to get really frothy, just blend it and then put it in the fridge and let the bubbles settle out of it. And you can reduce the volume like in half. I even done this with like, you know, mixed together like 150 grams of protein, you know, make a big, really big shake and just let it sit. And those bubbles are gone. And then drink that whenever your protein shakes need to be drunk. So that's another big one. That can help tremendously. Then you've got like 6 ounces or like 4 ounces of fluid to drink down as opposed to like 12 that's frothy and full of bubbles. That's very, very effective, actually. So those are a few little things.
I just I pulled up a picture of Trevor Smith. The dude was huge, man. He was tall. It looks like he was tall, too.
Yeah, I saw him. I mean, he was criticized like, you know, a lot of really, really big guys. Jordan, who's the, I'm blank on his name, the guy in the UK who was shooting for 400 pounds.
Dave
Crossland. He was sort of the U.S. version of Dave Crossland.
Okay.
Years before, and he had a heart attack, died in his kitchen. Trevor did.
Wow.
Yeah, but I saw him at the USA's one year, and just gigantic dude, big all around. And he used to, I don't think he could even, he used to always have to wear like football jerseys, like full size, yeah. You know, that would fit like an NFL football player with pads on, yeah. And he filled it out. Probably the picture you found is of him standing wearing a football jersey, because that's what I always see him in my mind's eye as wearing.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was a big dude.
He's huge. So, Jordan, just on this note, I know we've talked about it before, but I can't pass this up without talking a little bit about bagel and sorbet. You know, these are things I know that you found are great when you're trying to get your calories up high. I know for you, 6,000 calories, that's just called an easy day. But what do you have any other suggestions on fast? Dense carbohydrates that would be easy to digest?
I use a lot of Rice Krispie treat bars as well.
Oh, yeah. We did mention that before.
Mm-hmm. Around the workout perimeter, not usually pre-workout. Pre-workout, I find it really easy just to eat oats and honey. But my post-workout meal at the moment is bagels, cereal, Rice Krispie bars, sorbet. And I can do 400 grams of carbs in that meal.
Nice.
After having done 130 grams of intra-workout carbs. And that's usually no problem. Something that someone could do if they were very, very, very cautious.
Hmm.
And I'm not advising this, but someone could do it.
Know where you're going.
They could use their post-workout insulin and just wait until they start to maybe get a bit sweaty and they're just starting to let their blood sugar levels drop and their body suddenly goes, you need to fucking eat now. Once you hit that moment, you then just demolish everything that you have in front of you.
That's a good point.
It works like a treat. Someone very smart told me that that was quite a good thing to try. I'm not advising anyone do that.
Right. It's
dangerous, but someone could do that if they were struggling.
Interesting.
Of course, some people use GHRP6 in particular.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and that one, that will send some people, like, it's almost too much. It's like, I can't stop. Next thing I know, you know, I had two boxes of cereal.
Right.
I overshot my goal by a box.
I find that the GHRP hunger is fairly short-lived in the way that it will affect you. Let's say that you're trying to use that multiple times a day.
Mm.
It will start to lose its effects.
Wow.
And then I find that once it lost its effects, you are in trouble when it comes to getting your food in.
Interesting.
So I don't use that as an appetite tool now anymore.
Hmm.
I had the pass, and for the first like 2 to 3 weeks, I was like, wow, this is brilliant. And then after that, it's kind of stopped doing its thing. And with GHRP6, taking more isn't going to reap better results. I think you just end up stressing the hell out of your body and retaining a ton of water.
Okay.
And then once, like I said, the hunger effects diminished, I then literally hit a point where I just could not eat anything.
Hmm.
And I really thought that was, and I've never used it since then because of that, and I won't. So if you do have those issues with, like, every now and again, a post-workout meal, or you want to go for a meal, you just want to enjoy it by eating lots, then a GHRP6 shot before that could be good. But I'm not a huge fan of using that for hunger anymore.
Okay.
I think that would be kind of a get the most from the least type of scenario, like with so many other things.
Yeah.
Is that if you start using it like every meal, you know, or 2 or 3 times a day every day, you're gonna experience some adaptation and it'll no longer work. So, you know, like, just like Jordan said, you know, you use something like that sparingly, you know, as a kind of a trump card, if you would need it. Of course, only for those who were doing so is legal, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
Disclaimer.
Jordan, you mentioned before, we've talked in depth about Superdraw for pre-workout. Have you ever experimented with methyltren or M1T? And if so, were the effects as good?
Yeah, I found the methyl M1T to be a little too strong in terms of just screwing up appetite.
Mm.
I don't find Superdrol in reasonable dosages when you only use pre-workout to really have too much of a negative impact on appetite. And then the same with methyltrienolone. I found that to be okay as well. But for some reason, for me, M1T seemed to then just completely kill my appetite. And I felt pretty shoddy using that one. So I won't use that drug again. But
okay.
I did like the effects of methyltrienolone on strength. I've only ever used that towards the end of a prep. So I couldn't say how effective that was in muscle building. It's not the sort of drug that I would be keen to use in an off-season period, really.
Yeah.
Just because there are obviously phases where you know you're going to have to put your body under more stress. And typically that's when you get closer to a competition.
That makes sense.
It's kind of unavoidable in that phase that your body's going to be stressed. You're going to be using orals, and it's a possibility that you may be increasing your dosages throughout your prep just to help protect muscle mass and strength. So towards the end of a prep, yeah, your body's taking a bit of a beating. So if you've then been using those things in an off season as well, like, you're not going to last very long season to season until your blood work is just absolutely sharp pieces and your body kind of just says no.
Well, and you've said it's not just these things in particular, but really orals in general. You've kind of taken a stance against in the off season, right?
Yeah, like I played around with some stuff this off season, just when I was trying to burst back through some sticking points, for maybe 6 weeks. I was using some injectable orals, and that didn't affect my appetite, so I'm inclined to think then that the liver stress wasn't as high. But when I got blood work at the end, liver was still out, so like pretty badly. But there's just going to stress your body regardless.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things, really. I mean, it depends. I've said this before, it just depends where you're at with this and the risk versus reward. And you have to just be very aware that you can get away with doing it a few times, but there's a point at which you can't get away with it anymore. And the slower and the more patient you are with your approach to these things and not trying to use orals too frequently and using high dosages too often, you're going to last longer, which then means you, if you're training how you should be and eating how you should be, you're eventually then going to get bigger.
Yeah,
but it's going to take you a little bit longer. Like, but we all know this, but it is hard then not to be tempted to be like, well, I could just do a short stint of D-Bowl, because the short term results are pretty cool.
Yeah,
but I think it just depends how it makes you feel. Like it's easy for me because I feel like crap when I use them and I get too heavy. So I train so much better and I grow better when I don't feel shit like crap.
Yeah.
So you think, okay, well the oxys and the D-Bowl and like the M1T, they'll make you grow more, but for me they don't. They really don't make me grow more. Because I can't eat and I can't train as hard as I can.
Listen, I've had several people tell me now, and I feel like that it taught me to an extent, that after listening to the things you guys have said, and specifically what you're saying right now, Jordan, there's a lot of people who have changed their mind where we don't need to feel like crap in order to feel like we're doing something impactful. And yeah, man, I totally think that it's a kind of a new mindset almost for some of us in bodybuilding, that yeah, feeling good is really where you're going to make your best progress, right?
Oh yes. Like Scott said something to me when I was out in Tampa, last time we were there, and it always sticks with me, just the little things. Like you probably won't even remember like saying it, but it's just like, if you can get yourself into a position where you just feel really, really, really good, you will grow like crazy.
Yeah.
And so as soon as I start to feel shit, I'm like, no, get away from that feeling and that place and shift back off some water. Make sure that your blood pressure is good and you'll sleep better because your apnea won't be kicking your ass so much. And that means your recovery will be better. And all of a sudden, you'll have another burst of strength and progress. And it's so true. So if you are feeling like crap using these drugs, then I think you're doing it a little bit wrong. That's just my opinion anyway.
I think it's a good one.
Jordan, I actually remember that conversation. I think maybe at the condo.
Yeah.
I'm going to get all sort of woo here, but this, the nature of this question, the first thing I jotted down and looked at this question is, why not try these yourself? To answer that question, and not that I'm suggesting You know, the question is, why not? I'm not saying please do.
Yeah.
I'm not telling him what to do. But then you come to know these things. The idea is to know thyself. The best source of information that you have is the biofeedback your body's giving you as to where you're going. So we'll get questions that are asked, you know, should I do this and should I do this and should I do this? And, you know, a lot of these questions from White Ox, you know, or what would be the downsides of doing this, this, and this? And those are good questions to ask so that you don't, you know, make a bad error and end up hurting yourself. So that makes sense. But if you pay attention to what your body's telling you, you're getting a lot of information that you can trust in.
Hmm.
And figure these things out for yourself. If someone says, and this is what we will tend to do, like a coach will tell you this, you know, you need to take whatever methyltren, you know, before your workouts every day, and the person starts feeling like crap. I can't count the number of times I've read posts and people ask, like, you know, my coach says to do this, and I did it and did it and did it, and now I, you know, my eyes are greenish brown, you know, and I can't eat anything. So they're not paying attention to what's obvious. They're not believing in the own the feedback that their body's giving them, which is just about as good as it's going to get. If someone, you know, regardless of what I say, and you know, if your sense of things is that no, that's not right, that doesn't work for me, then you know, trust in the authority contained within you as opposed to someone, you know, who's telling you something otherwise, because I would put your own authority, yourself, your own biofeedback, at a level above that of someone else in many, many, many cases.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's a real solid point too.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
Yes.
This is one that I thought was, I wanted to turn to you, Scott, because I felt like if anybody had an answer for this one, it was going to be you. He asks about DMP. Is there any relationship to increased blood glucose levels? He said that his levels are around 110 to 130 fasted while on DMP, when normally he's like an 85, 90.
Yeah, this was one. I think Jordan and I went back and forth and talked about this, you know.
Yeah, this one confused me a bit initially.
Yeah, so here's the thing. We don't know. These, of course, his rats. So we don't know what he's feeding his rats.
Yeah, he said it was his rat was taking the DMP, just to be clear.
right. And actually, you know, it's important. I'm being facetious here, but rats and humans rely on blood glucose in substantially different ways, to be honest. So rats can use glucose really well as a carbohydrate source during exercise, much more so than humans, but
really,
they can, aside from that. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's taking in a lot more carbohydrate. So that may be part of what's going on here. He says resting blood glucose. I don't know if he says fasted blood glucose and his regular resting blood glucose is this. That may be part of it. The DMP, of course, has a very, very long half-life. Mm. And what DMP is doing, it's uncoupling oxidative phosphorylation. So the substrate that you break down that normally would be used to create a proton gradient across the inner mitochondrial matrix, which is, it's just like what a dam does. It converts the force of water flowing through the dam into electrical current, that, you know, with the turbines, et cetera, and you get power from that. What your body does with the food is breaks it down various ways, produces reducing equivalents, and then these basically become electrons that create a proton gradient, which is then harnessed when those protons flow back across from outside to the inside of the mitochondria across the inner mitochondrial matrix, an inner mitochondrial membrane. And DNP uncouples that. So those protons flow without harnessing their energy to produce ATP. So what this does then is it creates increased energy demand in the cells everywhere. And of course that means you know, you need more fuel. You need more energy from either incoming food or from your body fat stores, and you utilize body fat stores more and you get leaner. But it's doing that all over the place. It's not like DNP, you know, is somehow targeting your fat cells in particular. It's going to muscle cells. I believe it's crossing the blood-brain barrier as well. And it's also going to your liver cells. So we got a situation here where it would make sense to me that the energy demand in your hepatic cells is going to turn on glycogenolysis there. And what that is going to do is increase the glucose output from your liver. Okay. So that would raise, yeah. That also could be doing the same sort of thing in terms of suppressing insulin output. So that would elevate your blood glucose as well. This guy might also be using growth hormone as well, or his rats, which would tend to increase. So if he's like gone on a full blown, higher carb, growth hormone, cycle, and he's got these effects on his liver and his pancreas, all those can kind of combine, to increase your blood glucose. And of course the other thing too, is it's generally I'm just sort of speaking in a kind of a global fashion, but when you've got an increased energy demand like that, which is essentially what the DNP is doing, your body's going to try to protect itself. It's going to try to protect the brain first and foremost. If you don't have a conductor to drive the train, then the train's not going to do too well. The brain's dead, then the train isn't so good. The body's not good without a working brain. So it would make sense that, because this probably would produce a sympathetic response, and that in of itself is going to increase blood glucose from the liver.
Okay.
Blood glucose will tend to go up a little bit during exercise, especially if it's really intense. So that could be doing it. So those are kind of my guesses. I think the real thing he's wondering about is whether this is, a health issue.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Well, I think getting through the DNP cycle is maybe his first. I'd worry more about the DNP and, the free radical stress and that kind of thing, as opposed to being, slightly hyperglycemic during the course of this. So that's a nice theoretical question. I have fun trying to figure those puzzles out, but the bottom line is what happens when you're done. And so I can only speculate. I don't know what else he's doing.
Right.
Diet,
right.
Something wise. So,
all right, guys. Well, we're going to move on here, 'cause I kind of had a question of my own. So fortitude style training, we do these muscle rounds where you knock out 4 reps, and then you take 10 seconds, and then you knock out another 4, and you do this for 6 times. So there are periods of time where you have 10 seconds downtime. And I got through my very first section of the muscle round. And while I was looking up at the clock, I happened to look in the direction of a guy who was looking at me. And he took this as a cue to start talking to me. And so basically what I'm telling you is I got interrupted in the middle of a muscle round. I had texted both you guys, and I was like, you guys ever deal with that? Is this a thing? And both of you had told me no, I never get interrupted because basically you're working so damn hard. And as Jordan said, Scott's got veins popping out of, every inch of his face during these sets. And, in my defense, this was right after the very first, 4 reps. So it's not like I was deep in the set yet, but, I know that we've all dealt with people in the gym that distract us from what we're trying to do. And, Scott, you kind of went off on some really interesting stuff that we were talking about on text. I would love to ask you here on the show, how do you deal with this kind of thing?
Scott, I'm wondering, did you have a little bead of sweat go into your eye and then you blinked and maybe he thought you were winking at him?
It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah. He kind of swaggered on over and said, how you doing, big boy?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I was trying to ignore him. And at the same time, I didn't want to be rude. And then my training partner just said to him, he's like, hey, he's in the middle of a thing. He'll be done in just a minute, And then he gave me some space.
I use my watch most of the time to time the intervals. So that helps. 'Cause if you finish, sometimes you'll sense someone's kind of waiting in the wings, And so if you do your set and you put the weight down, first set of the muscle run, put your weight down and look at your watch.
Yeah.
That's sending a signal as well. And some of it's not just to send the signal. You're literally one at a time, obviously the rest interval. But, Yeah, it's an interesting one because there's such a wide spectrum of reasons for people being in the gym. And on one end, I mean, there are people I can remember in various gyms I've been to where their primary objective there is to have conversations, it seems like.
Yes.
That's what they're looking to do. And then there are some people, you know, that, you know, you just like, you can just tell there's just no, you're not even inclined to want to talk to this person, and they don't maybe even say something to them, you know, hey, are you on this machine? And they don't even speak to you. So no judgment on either of those, but you kind of have to, I think, address them in various ways. And then there's people that you can have conversations with throughout the course of the workout, but they know that you're there to train. Yeah. So like literally, you know, you say something and then, you know, you could stop mid sentence and they'll be like, they're not offended whatsoever. They just walk away. It's like, you know, no big deal. So there was one guy not too long ago. I think this is the one I mentioned in the text message. And I had talked to him. He'd seen me the previous weekend and he made some comments because he had spotted someone who came to one of the meetups I have here in Tampa. Wow. Woman, very strong. She trains like an animal. She's awesome to watch. He just came up to me and he started talking about her. I didn't know what he was talking about at first. We had a nice conversation. And then next time I was walking in the gym a couple of days later, he sees me like, and my vision isn't great. I couldn't even tell it was him. I just see this guy sees me like he's beelining. And I'm like, okay, this guy I can tell he's wanted to make me part of his social circle there in the gym in a way that is going to definitely not help with my workouts.
Yeah. You know,
which is, so I just said to him, and I've had to have these conversations many times. I tell you what, man, I just so you know, the way I'm in here training, I'm using rest intervals sometimes. So I will not be able to like have conversations really almost at all. Like maybe when I'm loading up a weight or what have you, but, I seriously just won't be able to do that. I just want to let you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I won't even see you. I mean, I'm literally on the verge of death. So, and the analogy that I give, and I think I gave it for this guy, is it's sort of like, imagine if you saw someone who's like a, you know, who's a high-end, you know, it's Greg LeMond, you know, he's a high-end cyclist. And the guy's, you know, he's got like this $4,000 cycle and he's got the team logo on his shirt and he's riding down the road, you know, at these incredible speeds. And you can tell this guy is just, he's a high-performance machine and he's training full bore. You probably wouldn't drive up to him in your car and say, hey, buddy, how'd you get so fast? Or
right.
You know, how fast can you ride that bike? you know, which is a funny example. I mean, of course you wouldn't do that, you know, especially if you've got headphones on, which is another kind of a sign.
Right.
But so by analogy, if someone, you know, comes up and says, like, while you're, you know, you look like you're about to die because, you know, you're breathing like a locomotive and says, you know, how much weight is that, you know, on a machine, it sort of doesn't really fit with what that person's doing. You're not really clued into the fact that they're there to absolutely kick ass and take names and not do, you know, a seminar on how to add the weight that's on a machine, something like that. So he took it totally. I mean, I literally talked to him for like 10 minutes trying to explain that, you know, and I answer some of his questions, and he's a good guy, and he's totally cool now. I see him, you know, kind of give me a wave every once in a while, and he doesn't, like try to jump in my field of vision and, you know, flag me down or anything like that. He totally knows what's up, and I say hello when I walk in, and then never been an issue.
Nice.
So it seems like, yeah, the issue can be is if you don't address someone who may have that tendency to want to, like, ask you a bunch of questions just by letting them know kind of what's up, then you can end up coming off kind of as a butthead because they just don't sense, you know, where you're coming from. It's a totally new perspective to them. They're just riding out for a nice little, you know, ride of their bike on the beach, you know,
right.
You know, honking their horn and they got their, you know, their picnic in their basket on their bike. And
they assume they're, you are too, right?
Right. Even though you obviously could tell, like, I'm there to, like, you know, I'm doing time trials today and, you know, getting ready for the Tour de France.
Right.
So that's kind of how I figured out seems to work pretty well.
Jordan, I imagine with your size that you just you're very imposing, I'm sure, when you're training. Do you get guys though that still want to come up to you and talk mid set?
No.
I figured that was the answer, but I'm sure it's had to happen once or twice, huh?
No.
So what's the secret? You're just there to train hard, and it's just basically obvious to everybody is what it comes down to, huh?
Most of the time, it's just because my breathing's pretty shit when I'm
yeah.
Like, I'm either getting ready to do a set, or doing a set, or then bent over double trying to breathe after a set.
Mm.
So, yeah. I've had a guy once tried to talk to me when I was doing a muscle round, which then led into like another tag on exercise. So I think we finished the muscle round and then we hopped onto like a leg extension.
Yeah.
As I said, and he tried to speak to me after I just finished a Smith squat muscle round between moving to that and the leg extension. And that was the only time I've ever had it happen. And he's a client of mine as well. And all I could muster was not now. which came out pretty bad, but I was, honestly, I was fucked. Smith squat muscle round for me is, like, scary. Like, I love it, but I hate it.
Mm.
How it makes me feel afterwards. Is the kind of the oxygen debt that I create, my breathing. I can't even keep up with it. I panic breathe when I finish.
Mm.
And I have to hyperventilate before I do the set to try to have enough oxygen in me that I don't panic breathe after the set, which I still can't really ever do. I start to panic breathe and that's it. So I then had an email from him that night telling me how upset he was that I talked to him in that way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's funny is this guy's a pilot as well. Smart guy. And I said to him, you have to remember, in that moment, that is my job.
Yeah.
And you, just like someone coming into your cockpit and going, hey, whilst you're trying to land a plane.
Hmm.
Like, in that moment, in that very second there, that's my job. I'm in there to do that job. And it's not acceptable to be disturbed in that moment. And then when I put it to him like that, he then apologized and said he was really sorry. He'd never thought of it like that.
Hmm.
I wish that I could have very politely said, give me one moment. I couldn't even barely bark out the not now because I just couldn't breathe.
Yeah. So what is it about the Smith machine squat? Is it that you don't have to use the stability of the free weight bar so you can just keep getting the reps? Or is it that you can load so much weight? Why is it that you feel this is so intense?
It'd be the same as a V-squat machine, I suppose, as well.
Okay.
Or it's just any of those squat variation muscle rounds where you're moving your body through space.
Hmm.
I find those very, very, very hard. Especially when I'm heavy. But the last time I was out with Tampa, with Scott in Tampa, I was pretty light. I was only like 258, and we smashed these squat muscle rounds.
Yeah.
And we made them even harder then because Scott came up with some fucked up way of making them stupid. So we literally were like just killing each other on these. And then they were fine at that weight. But once I'm like 275, 280, I find them just, they're like torture, to be honest.
Hmm.
They're so hard. but fun. So.
Do you guys...
What's the difference between like a, you know, doing a squat and doing a biceps curl?
Yeah. You know,
biceps curl or a breeze, you know, relatively speaking, compared to a squat or a deadlift.
True.
Or any type of, you know, compound exercise.
Yeah,
but, you know the thing that I've done, because I do get that, I've gotten it more than once where someone comes up to you and because they don't know what you're doing, they're like, well, he must be done, even though he's, you know, he's waddling very, you know, with a very pointed intent towards this other machine, like, you know, he's it's not like he's running to the bathroom. He's going there for a reason. Is I just use the single, just raise a finger and just like, you know, say, even if I can't speak, I'll just say, just a sec, like literally raise one finger, you know, like just a minute. And then people, I mean, what happens most of the time is they don't bother to wait. You know, go looking for those folks and they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, I try to seek them out and say, hey, you know, I presume I give them the benefit of the doubt, that there's the question was important enough, you know, I would say like, I don't know, 9 out of 10 times, that it's usually someone who's, they're done with their workout. This is only my explanation I can come up with. So now that they're done, they have a question that's been burning a hole, for their entire workout, and they're going to get you on the way out. So when you say just a minute, or sometimes I say I'll be done in 10 minutes if I know I'm like doing loading sets. So I literally will be done with the zigzagging of those. And I know 10 minutes is, you know, always going to be pretty accurate. Then those people, they don't, obviously wasn't that important enough to wait around. So they're gone. But the one finger up, because yeah, not now. That one doesn't come across. It's just like nothing you can do. It's totally the, you know, appropriate response in terms of what you're trying to say, but it comes across like so poorly, like Jordan said.
Yeah.
But the finger is okay. Just a minute. Like literally, it's like you're their servant in a way. It's like, you know, like, yeah, like you're working at a bar or, you know, or something like that. You're working in a restaurant and they're trying to get your attention. And, you know, if the waiter says not now, like that's like, what the hell is this? But if you say just a minute or I'll be right with you, which is if I just have like that programmed in my head just to say that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just to think of it that way.
Thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah. It works really well. So
I'll have to remember that one then in the future. And I, you know what, we're here at the new year. So there is going to be probably starting today, Monday at the gym, first Monday of the year, there's probably going to be more people than I can comprehend going to the gym that have no clue of what we are trying to do there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. Well, that brings us to the end here. And this was a lot of fun. I'm glad that we could start the new year out, you know, with a bang here. Pretty much, we had some really good questions. For anybody that wants to ask some questions, head over to the Advices Radio forum. If you go to advicesradio.com, there's a link to it on the front of the page there, and we have a thread for Muscle Minds. So dive in, and you can leave your question there, and hopefully we'll eventually be able to get to it. We've got a backlog of questions now, which is awesome. And you know, as we've mentioned a couple times, we're gonna be kind of a little bit more picky as to what we answer. We want it to be stuff that will be, you know, good and entertaining for everybody. So if we don't get to your question, you know, don't take offense to it. And you know, I'd be happy to try to talk to you about it, you know, on the message board too, if we can't answer it here. Guys, I want to give you a shout out too. We're putting some commercials together now, so those should be airing on the show here. But if you guys haven't gone over to trainedbyjp.com, definitely check that out. Jordan has some really cool stuff. There's new content, video content that's coming out every day, and he has a ton of great information over at his site. And of course, fortitudetraining.net, and that's for Dr. Scott Stevenson. You know, ton of information. You can check out the Fortitude ebook over there as well. I appreciate both you guys doing this, because this is it's a really cool service to bodybuilding, and I've actually witnessed it. Like I said about that one question, Jordan, I've had people come up to me, people in my gym, or people sometimes when I'm trying to work out, even they tell me, you know, things that they've learned, and their education is improving and their bodybuilding is getting better. So I think you guys should know that too, that it's really means a lot to a lot of people.
Oh, good. That's pleasing to know.
So guys, we will be back in a couple of weeks. For Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. This has been Muscle Minds Episode 2.
Thanks, guys.
All right, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Happy New Year.